Yeah,
yeah.
How does a cult make money? Is it just from the whales, the big players? Is that how a cult functions?
That's why cults like to recruit rich people. They get money that way. A lot of them have businesses that are fronts. You know, there's cults that have cafes and restaurants and, you know, yoga practices, God knows what. They'll have. And that's why also they don't want to recruit. You know, the myth is it's stupid, weird, crazy, lazy people who get into cults. Well, cults don't want stupid, weird, crazy, lazy people.
Dr. Lalic is a little Serbian in the background in the name there. I hear. Did you were born there, or what's the story?
No. My father was born there, and he came over when he was about 16. And my mother's parents were born there, and they came over separately. She was about, I think, 13 or 14. She came over all by herself. I know. And then I guess the Serbian introduced them, and they got married and moved out to Wisconsin, and the story goes from there.
So did you learn any Serbian or no?
You know, those were the days you wanted to be American, so I refused to learn, which I really regret now. I mean, I know how to say Merry Christmas and stuff like that, but no, I didn't learn the language. But I grew up in that community, going to the church on Sunday, which was incredible. You know, the guy waves this incense around. And then we had these big picnics afterwards, like next to the church, there was a Serb hall and a big grounds, and they would be out there barbecuing whole lambs during the church service.
Right.
And
oh, yeah.
The lamb mixed with the incense, you know, and then we'd have,
magical smell.
Yeah. And everybody'd go out and get a hunk of lamb and some pogača bread and just raw green onions and eat. And then they'd have a big dancing afterwards with the Serbian orchestra, you know, a little band playing tamburica.
Yeah, of course. Did you ever experience the other side of this, the torturous side where you have to stand and listen to a priest for an hour straight?
Well, yeah. I mean, on our saint's day, the priest would come over to the house and bless the house and wave his stuff around. Yeah, no, it was, and it's, you know, obviously a very patriarchal religion. So there was that, you know, like my father was very old country, and I wasn't supposed to go to college. He said, no, you're not going to go to college. Like,
really?
He said, you know, you have big hips, so you're going to marry a nice Serbian boy. And because you have big hips, you're going to have nice Serbian boy babies. And I'm like, no, not doing that. So anyway.
That's so interesting, because my mom had the exact opposite situation with that. Her dad's like, you're going to go to school, you're going to get educated. Like, it's non-negotiable. And she was like, I don't know. He's like, no, you're going to go to school. So it's interesting. Yeah, so
what nationality was he?
My parents both are Serbian.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yes,
oh, that's fantastic.
Yes. I was born and raised in Serbia. I lived there until I was 7. Then we moved to Canada. So I actually speak Serbian, and yeah, my parents are both Serbian.
Oh, wow. And so what part of Serbia?
It's near Belgrade. It's like 45 minutes. It's a little town called Sremska Mitrovica. It's very, very small, like 50,000 people.
Yeah. I was there the first time I went there was in the 60s. And I was doing my junior year in France, and we rented a car, 5 of us. We rented a little Peugeot, and we drove from southern France all the way to Yugoslavia. And, you know, there were no tourists then at all. And, you know, we'd drive down these dirt roads, and there'd be a lady with a little wooden booth, and she'd be selling pogača, you know, which is the round bread. And I'd go up to get some bread, and she would look at me and she'd say, Serbska, Serbska. Like, she could tell from my face that I was Serbian. It was so much fun. But that was a great trip. I mean, no, you know, there was the only foreign cars on the road were like German trucks. You'd sometimes see a German, but there were no tourists there then. It was fantastic.
Yeah, you had those little Yugo cars, those little boxy cars. My parents had one of those. Those are adorable.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, that's a great connection.
Yeah. Okay. So the reason I kind of, I'm interested in your upbringing, because you're an expert on cults, you're an expert on various topics in this space. How much does upbringing have to do with eventually entering a cult and stuff like that?
Well, I don't think it has a lot to do with it. I mean, it's really about, you know, it's about a moment of vulnerability, which, and we're all vulnerable a jillion times in our lives. It's not some kind of illness. It's like, you know, we move to a new town, or we just graduate college, or we just got divorced, or our dog just died, or it's raining out. You know, if in any of those moments, something comes along that in some way appeals to you and you're curious and you check it out, you can get involved in a cult. So, I mean, I think the only thing about my background was we were rather discriminated against, you know, in the 50s and when I grew up. And so people made fun of us. We had funny names. You know, we went to a funny religion. We lived in this all German Catholic neighborhood, and the kids would tell me I was going to go to purgatory because I wasn't a Catholic. And I think because of that experience, you know, it made me want to work toward changing society. So the kind of cult I got in was, you know, we were supposedly going to make the revolution and get rid of sexism and racism and all those isms, you know. And so the cult, if people join a cult, it has to be something that resonates in some way, right? Like I always say, I never would have joined a meditation cult. I mean, I can't sit still that long, you know, but a cult that said we're going to change the world. Yeah. I mean, of course I didn't know it was a cult. So there has to be that link, and they draw you in, they quote, love bomb you, make you feel very special, feel obligated to come back, and boom, it goes from there. So as far as I can tell, there's no particular background or personality type. I mean, if anything, it's, you know, the common denominator is idealism. You know, it's people who want a better something.
I guess if there was a common denominator, it would be very easy to spot, or it'd be very easy to see it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like all these Serbian people that came to America are all in a cult. Like, okay, I think we can safely say that there's something there, right?
Right.
I was also wondering from a biological perspective, probably not. If I'm reading the room, I'm assuming there's also no like genetic traits or certain person, I guess personality things for sure. But in terms of genetics, there's also nothing there as well, right?
No,
that's what makes it so difficult to predict and kind of protect yourself against these things.
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, it's really all types of people from all walks of life. Obviously, cults target rich people because they want to get a hold of that money. And a lot of rich people kind of feel guilty about having so much money. And so they prey upon that. You know, I mean, it's creative people. It's curious people. You know, there's no one thing. And they're very, you know, cults are very good at what they do. I mean, they have whole recruitment strategies, and they're pretty successful.
Right. It's there's no kind of medium though, right? Because it's either you are one of these people that is completely like not going to buy into a cult, or you're one of these people that's going to go 100%, right? Is there a medium?
Well, I'm sure there are people who say, oh, I would never join a cult. And those are probably the most vulnerable, right? Because they're not going to be looking out for the signs, right?
Sure. Sure.
So again, I mean, I think a little bit, maybe more women join cults, especially today because of, you know, there's so many of these groups, like in the wellness industry and in the self-help industry and all of that. And especially here in America, we have this kind of quick fix culture, right? So I think on some level, it might be slightly more women than men percentage wise. And also women aren't especially educated to look out for people who are going to take advantage of them. Right. I mean, that's still true despite all the gains of the women's movement. So, and today there are more women cult leaders. And I think some people think, oh, well, you know, this is a woman. It's going to be fine. You know, it's not some creepy, you know, so-called charismatic guy. So,
right. Also, I guess going back to your point, American culture is also very much we want to buy a solution or we want a quick fix. We don't want to do something that's going to be long and difficult. I mean, look at obesity, for example, in the country. That's not an easy fix, but there is a fix. But they don't want to accept that as the fix, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. I mean, it's this quick fix culture. It's the effects of the New Age movement from the 70s on, where, you know, people are poo-pooing Western science and those kinds of traditions. And so they see some guru from India and they think, oh my God, he's this magical person. He's got the answer, when, you know, and unfortunately people don't do their research. You know, right now the internet is used a lot for recruiting into cults, but there's also so much information on the internet. And if people just slowed down and did their research before they sign on to something, I think they could avoid a lot of misery by ending up in something that's harmful to them.
It goes two ways. It's very difficult also because there's a lot of misinformation on there, and misinformation can be well disguised. And to the average person, maybe even a below average IQ person, it's very easy to start getting to rabbit holes because you do, like I said, you want that easy answer. You want it to make sense. You don't want something that's a little bit outside of your spectrum of thought, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's a human characteristic that we're all looking for that community to belong to. We're all looking for answers, you know, especially today, the society is so complex. And so people, you know, want to have meaning in life. They want to have a framework for understanding, and cults offer all that. So, you know, they're there to pick you up for sure.
Speaking of which, I want to know how did you get started in your, how did you get in your cult, I guess? At what age, what specifically happened? Was there a moment? Was it, you know, they were chiseling away until eventually you were fully in?
Yeah. So what happened with me is, I had already been to college. I had a BA from University of Wisconsin in French. I got a Fulbright fellowship. I went back to France for a year. I did the hippie years. I did all this different stuff. As I was mentioning to you earlier, I lived on a Spanish island for 4 years. So it was when I left the island and I came back, I came to San Francisco because a college roommate was living there. And I was almost 30 years old, and I was new in town. I was meeting new people. I was actually coming out as a lesbian, and so that was like a big transition happening in my life. Yeah. And I met a woman who was a friend of a friend, and we'd have these, you know, we'd run into each other on the street, and she'd invite me for coffee, and we'd have these incredible conversations about politics. And this was just at the end of the Vietnam War, and so, you know, people on the left were kind of like trying to figure out what to do. And she said, oh, well, you know, we have a study group that's looking at the role of women in the state. And, you know, would you be interested in joining the study group? Well, that seemed wonderful. I mean, I thought I'll meet new people. I'll meet like-minded people. I always had this sort of intellectual side to me. So I joined the study group. I didn't know, obviously, that it was a front for a cult. I didn't know that half of the people in the study group were already in this background organization and were just there to recruit the rest of us, right?
Wow, yeah.
And so we were reading all this different, like, revolutionary literature, like Marx and Lenin and Chairman Mao and all that kind of stuff. And so they'd ask you to do, each person would lead the discussion, you know, in the next meeting. And when I led my discussion, you know, they praised me and told me how wonderful I was and how smart I was and, you know, all this like ego stuff. And then the same woman asked to meet with me again in my apartment. And she and another woman came over and said, oh, well, you know, what are you learning in the study group? And I said, well, I'm learning that if you really want to make social change, you have to have a Marxist-Leninist disciplined organization. And she said, oh, well, what if we told you we have one of those? And I'm like, oh, wow.
Wow, that's crazy.
And of course, she told me it was international and it was diverse and it was all this stuff, you know, which was a total lie. But so I was intrigued and I said, yeah, I'd be interested in joining. So then they do this kind of bait and switch. And she said, well, here's a questionnaire. Fill out this, you know, application, and and then we'll get back to you. So the application, of course, asked me everything about my life, my parents, what they did, everything I've done, my bank accounts, my passport number, everything. So at that point, they had everything about me, right? And I gave that to her, and you know, a week later or whatever, and then she came back to me at some point and said, you know, great, you've been admitted. So again, I didn't really know what I was joining. At that point, it didn't even have a name. You know, I was told it was this huge organization. There, in fact, at that point, there were maybe 20 members, 25, right? And so it just kind of went from there. I mean, I was told to be on call 24 hours a day. I was told to take a new name. I was immediately given like very impressive assignments. I was initially the secretary to the central committee. So I'd sit in on these meetings and take notes, and I'd hear everything they were planning and talking about. And then I'd have to type up the notes and deliver it to all of them before 6 a.m. So I started being sleep deprived, you know, and it went from there.
Maybe this is a really stupid question, but do they pay you for any of this? Or did
No. I worked my ass off for over 10 years, never got a dime. Oh, no.
How did you survive? How do you...
Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. I did get a dime. I got a very minimal amount of money. And of course, people in the group, the people who worked, turned over, everybody lived on the same amount of money. It was like below poverty level. I don't know. It was like $400 a month or something back then.
Wow. Right?
So this was like 1975, 76. So people who work turned over everything but that minimal amount. And then it was divvied up among those of us who were full time, were given our share. And of course, most of it went to the cult leader. And then we had a finance committee who figured out like how many people should work and what they should earn, keep the thing going. And then we had some very wealthy members who gave a lot of money and bought cars and vans and things like that. And so it just,
How does a cult make money? Is it just from the whales, the big players? Is that how a cult functions?
That's why cults like to recruit rich people. They get money that way. A lot of them have businesses that are fronts. You know, there's cults that have cafes and restaurants and, you know, yoga practices, God knows what they'll have. And that's why also they don't want to recruit, you know, the myth is, it's stupid, weird, crazy, lazy people who get into cults. Well, cults don't want stupid, weird, crazy, lazy people. They want A-type personalities because they want you to run the businesses. They want you to recruit. They want you to bring in, you know, other big people who will lend legitimacy to the group.
I mean, look at what Scientology has done in Hollywood, right? I mean,
exactly,
some of the biggest
exactly.
fish, yeah.
Yeah, so that's who they look for. I mean, if we had, at one point we had someone who joined our cult at the very sort of what we called the general membership level. And, you know, she was clearly a troubled person. And the leader said, oh, get rid of her. She's going to be trouble. You know, cults aren't there to take care of you. You're there to take care of the cult and the cult. So that whole idea that, you know, there's something wrong with people who join cults or that they're stupid, that's not true at all.
I guess this is another question. Did you think getting like $400 a month or below poverty was like how did you perceive that as acceptable? Or you're like, oh, I'm doing something for a good cause. I don't really care about money. That's the thought process.
Yeah. I mean, you end up rationalizing everything, right? And we were told,
right.
There's this quote from Chairman Mao that says the revolution isn't a tea party, right? So we were told, don't expect this to be easy. You know, you're being a martyr for the cause. You know, the revolution isn't going to happen in our lifetime, but we're building the groundwork. So just think of yourselves as a martyr and don't worry if you're not happy.
Once you said, they can do whatever the hell they want to you, right? Once they set
right.
that rule, then... Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And you're not supposed to be happy. So don't complain. You know, they made it all fit together very tightly. Smart.
So what's your normal day in those years, I guess, in as a part of this thing?
Well, my normal day, I was most of the time I was in top leadership and I was in the inner circle with the leader. So a lot of my time was spent in meetings. A lot of my time was reviewing reports. At one point, I ran the recruitment program and everybody was expected to turn in recruitment reports almost every week. So I would review those reports, figure out who seemed like a prime target. And then I would work with that other cult member to figure out the plan to meet with that person and recruit them. I also led a lot of the classes and designed a lot of the curriculum. I led, you know, various internal organizations. Like we had something we called the Discipline and Control Board, where if somebody did something wrong, supposedly they'd come before us and we'd figure out what punishment they should have. So most of my work was internal. Some people were assigned jobs and what jobs to have and where. But my work was always internal. So it was just day to day doing administrative work or leading criticism sessions. Eventually, the leader told me to build a publishing house because she knew I was into writing. And so my last years in the cult were building and running the publishing house, which meant that I would get us books to print and distribute. I would set up distributors. I would go to like publishing conferences. And that was very helpful to me when I got out because I actually made some really good contacts.
Right, right. What was the worst thing you saw? Because you do hear like horror stories of like Scientology related like activities where they make you clean the entire house with a toothbrush or stuff like that. Did you ever see any, I don't know, kind of really bad things, but you brushed it off or you, I guess, like you said, rationalized it?
I mean, I think one incident that always sticks out in my mind is there were actually 9 women who started the group with the leader, and she was always the leader, and the leader systematically kind of got rid of the other founders. But one of the women had complained about something, and so she was put under what we called house arrest. And she was made to sit in a basement of someone's house in a straight back chair like this and not move and not speak for as long as we kept her there. And there were 24-hour guards on her.
Wow.
That was pretty bad. Another bad thing was we had a member who was French. She was one of the founders, actually. And at one point, again, she raised something. This was early on. And they basically gave her passport, put her on a plane back to France without a penny, and she was gone. And of course, just, you know, we would have these fake trials where someone would get put on trial. It was like sort of like the Russian, you know, purge trials. And so someone would get put on trial and have to sit in front of, you know, maybe 40 people criticizing them for hours on end. And you're not allowed to move or speak, or you can't cry. You're never supposed to show any emotion. It was a lot of stuff like that. And of course, the worst things was being in the inner circle and having to be around the leader, because she was basically an alcoholic, megalomaniac, crazy woman. And we would have these sessions at her house. She had a house in the country that we pretty much bought for her. And we'd have these inner, you know, these meetings there with those of us in the inner circle, and she'd be drinking and we'd have to keep up with her drinking, and she'd make us sing the House of the Rising Sun. This was her favorite song, and you'd have to make up a verse. And if she didn't like the verse, she'd slap you. And she would threaten the men that was going to make them go upstairs and have sex with her. And I mean, they were just brutal, brutal sessions that would go on like all night long. Those were pretty awful. As well as I had to travel in Europe with her a lot because I spoke languages. And so those were also horrible times. And I always just rationalized it. You know, I would say things like, well, you know, we have Stalin in our lineage and at least we haven't killed anyone yet. I mean, that's how I would rationalize her behavior. So
what's interesting is that there's no criminality. And I mean, these are activities. Yeah. The slap assault, of course, but if you're of your own will there and you've accepted this as a punishment for your behavior, there's nothing there that can be taken to a court or a police officer. So it just goes on forever because you're choosing to be there.
Well, you're actually not choosing to be there. I mean, you're not choosing to be there of your own free will. And so this is the problem there. You know, there's this concept of coercion, and unfortunately law enforcement or the courts don't yet understand about coercion, that people can, you know, can be coerced into doing things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. And so like I have so many cases like this. I'll have a husband call me and he'll say, you know, my wife has given like $500,000 to this bogus energy worker in another state, and I can't get her to stop. And so he goes to the police, and the police say, look, she's 40 years old. She can do what she wants to do with her money. And he's like, but it's my money, you know, but, right. You know, it's, I don't understand. So it's really difficult to bring charges. You have to have actual evidence. And, you know, right now, I mean, there are some cases that have been successful that focused on like federal crimes, like labor trafficking, sex trafficking. I mean, those are the ways we can get people. Yeah. But it's tough.
It's an interesting line then, because I don't know if you know, there's this drug in Colombia. Basically, if someone blows it in your face, you kind of go into like almost like a zombie state where they can give you orders and you could do things. I don't know if you've heard of this. I forgot. It's called Devil's Breath. No, it's called Devil's Breath. It's, yeah. So that, I mean, that's obviously a criminal action. You've intoxicated someone. And now you're making them, let's say, go to their bank account, take out their money. But if you could have the same effect with your words, your charisma, your ability, and you do the exact same actions, people are like, oh, yeah, they're just dumb or exactly. Like they're naive. It's a really interesting thing.
It's very frustrating. I'm telling you, it's very frustrating.
So for how many years? So you said 10 years? You were
I was about 10 and a half years. So I was almost 41 when I got out, and I was pretty much brain dead. I mean, I felt like I was 15 years old. I went to New York because I moved to New York because I wanted to get away from San Francisco and all the memories and all the street corners where we sold our newspaper and all that crap. And, I was, you know, I got a job, but I was really at night, I would sit home and I would try to write about my experience, and I would just cry and drink brandy. And, you know, I was kind of a mess. And luckily at one point I found a really good therapist who worked at the time there was a cult clinic in New York. And I found this terrific therapist who really saved my life. I mean, I was suicidal for a long time because I felt so ashamed of the things I had done while I was in the cult.
Obviously you felt an overwhelming sense of lost time for
lost, you know, time, lost friends, yeah. Lost everything. Yeah. I mean, when I, you know, again, I was 40 years old. Most of the people my age already owned homes or, you know, had careers and, you know, and I just felt like a stupid little kid. I could barely figure out how to cross the street. So it's, you know, recovery is difficult, but very important.
Sure. You said San Francisco in the 70s, right? That's mm-hmm. when all of this was happening. Is that around the time that there was also a lot of those psychedelic cults? Jolly West had, I forgot.
Yeah, Jolly West did the... Well, Dr. West did those experiments. He was a psychologist in LA at a clinic. But yeah, mostly what was going on in the 70s in the San Francisco was the Patty Hearst case, where this group called the Symbionese Liberation Army kidnapped Patty Hearst, who was the daughter of William Randolph Hearst, who had the Hearst Corporation, owned all the newspapers, was a big millionaire. And they kidnapped her and kept her in a closet for like 6 weeks and basically indoctrinated her. And when she came out, you know, she picked this name Tanya, and they went around robbing banks. And a person got killed at one of the banks. And so there was this search going on in the Bay Area and in LA, looking for Patty Hearst and the other members of the SLA. So that actually was the excuse in our organization for having all this security, right? Because we thought, oh, you know, the Red Squads are going to come and find us. So we had to use different names. We couldn't tell anybody our real names. We had to park 2.5 blocks away from our houses. We could only make calls with phone booths in the days of phone booths. Right. And, you know, we had all kinds of security regulations. And it was all justified by the fact that, you know, the FBI was everywhere and all the police departments were forming red squads. And so again, it was a way to sort of rationalize the behavior.
I'm trying to remember what the drug was that no, not PTSD. It's why can't I forget? The Jolly West was doing a lot of experimentation with that drug. It was a psychedelic.
LSD.
Oh my God, LSD. That's what it was. Yeah. Did you have a chance to read Tom O'Neill's book called Chaos?
I don't think
Tom O'Neill. No. Chaos. Tom O'Neill is a journalist who spent 20 years studying the Charles Manson case. And he discovered a lot of conflicting issues with the original story with Vince Bugliosi, which was the lawyer at the time. And he doesn't have the definitive evidence, but from all the research and all the stuff he did compile, it seems like Manson was doing those psychedelics and he was a part of the CIA. I would strongly recommend reading the book. It's a New York Times bestseller. They never went on record, and they obviously never will. I'm not going down a conspiracy rabbit hole here. This is a well documented, well researched book. It took him 30 years to write it, and he's also not a conspiracy theorist. But there's a lot of interesting stories about information being hidden from attorneys and all these massive cover ups happening, basically to hide the real story of what happened with those murders, which were by the cult. I forgot the name of the cult, but it was the people that killed those people in Hollywood. They were cult members, right?
Yeah, they were Manson, in the Manson family.
Manson cult, right? And they were experimenting a lot with LSD. And this was the time, apparently, that CIA was interested in learning about LSD and seeing if maybe they can start applying some of the techniques to their soldiers, obviously, which would be of immense benefit to any military in the world if you can mind control or get someone to do something without their own will. So if I can recommend one book, Chaos by Tom O'Neill. He was also on the Joe Rogan podcast.
How do you spell O'Neill? Is it N-E-A-L or N-E-I-L?
O-N-E-I-L, I believe. But you can't miss the book. It's called Chaos.
I'll look it up. I'll look at it if I have time, but I knew Jolly West very, very really? Well. Oh yeah, oh yeah. He was one of the key people in the 70s and 80s that did anything about cults. I mean, and Margaret Singer, I don't know if you've heard of her. Margaret Singer was a
clinical. No, I have not.
Okay, so Dr. Singer was a clinical psychologist at Berkeley, and she had worked with Robert Lifton and Edgar Schein back in the 50s when they wrote their books, The Psychology of Thought Reform and Coercive Persuasion. So she was a key figure, and for years she was the preeminent go-to person around cult stuff. And I worked with her for years, and she mentored me in a way. She's the one who encouraged me to go to grad school. And so, through her, I got to meet Jolly West. And I mean, all of us went to the same conferences and stuff back in the day. So, I'll check it out. And I've heard stuff before, but I'm always pretty skeptical about that kind of thing.
I'm really curious to see what you'll think. Like I said, it took him 30 years to write it. I'd say it's actually Tarantino, as it's one of his recommended books. The reason I say all this is because I talked to Tom O'Neill a few months ago, maybe a year ago at this time, and he was telling me about his book, and he told me like he had a conversation with Tarantino, because at the time Tarantino was working on the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is obviously a romanticized version of what he wanted to happen. That's why it's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So it's a really interesting story, really interesting book. Conspiracy theory or that, not from that element, at least.
But if Manson was working for the CIA, you think they would have done something to keep him out of prison? Although I know they tell you it's your risk. They're never going to come out and say you're one of them, but.
Right. So that's interesting. That's a good point that you brought up. So there was actually many times when Manson got caught on parole and he was just released. He was released without any real explanation as to why anyone on parole, he was crossing state lines, and all the documents say like, oh yeah, this was above my pay grade. I was told to let him go. Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. I think I'm butchering the book, or maybe I'm doing it a disservice. So I'm not a 30-year expert on it. I just was, I fell in love with the story. And mostly, I mean, yes, the story is interesting, but Tom, the character in the book, or him as the author or as the writer, it's fun to hear his side and him chase the story that he, you know, took him 30 years to write the actual book. It was supposed to be just a magazine, two paragraph cover, and then it turned into this massive journey.
Wow. Well, I'll check it out.
So anyways, you're also extremely busy. You're busier now than ever, probably, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Does it feel like you're getting back some of those years that you maybe you lost? You're in documentaries, you're writing books. How does this lifestyle now? How does it feel to you?
Well, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, I taught for 20 years as a sociology professor. And during that time, I also did a lot of cult-related stuff. But in 2019, I decided I would retire from the university. And I moved back to the Bay Area. And I thought, okay, I'm going to just lay back. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. So I thought, oh, I'll just sit here and write my memoir. And boom, my emails exploded because everyone wanted to talk to me about their uncle who fell down a rabbit hole. So between QAnon and the anti-vaxxer movement, I started getting pretty active again. And then all these documentaries came out about cults. And so now everybody's more or less hip to the cult thing. And yeah, I've been busier than ever. I mean, I do love it. I've just started a nonprofit organization called the Lalich Center on Cults and Coercion. And I'm training people because I'm 78 years old. And I think, you know, I'm not going to last forever.
You look great. You look fantastic and you're sharp as a knife, it seems.
I wish my body felt that way. Talk to my knees. But anyway, I feel like I'm working toward leaving some kind of legacy and making sure there's people who can carry on with the work I've been doing for the last 30 some years. And so it's exciting. I mean, I'm sometimes too busy and I don't take care of myself the way I should in terms of eating healthy foods or whatever. But I've recently hired a massage therapist who comes every other week to the house. And so, you know, I'm beginning to take care of myself a little better, but I love it. I mean, I just feel like this work is having so much impact. I mean, I work with so many survivors and we have discussion groups with survivors and courses and whatnot. And so, I think
what's
it's
the target
great.
Audience of the, what, I'm going to ask you, sorry to interrupt you. May I ask you, what, like the books you've written, is that designed more so for people that are currently in cults or people that are friends of people that are in cults? What's the goal, I guess, of, you have many books, obviously.
I think all of the books are really down to earth, written in plain English. I mean, even Bounded Choice, which is basically a user-friendly version of my dissertation and explains my whole theory and framework that I use, the bounded choice idea. But the books are, I mean, Take Back Your Life is clearly, it's a recovery book. So it's clearly meant for survivors, but it's also really helpful for therapists who are working with cult survivor clients. It's helpful for families so that they see what their person is going to be going through if they leave the cult. And Escaping Utopia, the focus of that book is children. I did about 69 interviews with people who were born or raised in a cult and who left on their own, and how did they manage in the quote outside world. So that book is extremely helpful also for anybody just to understand what these folks go through, but also for...
Well, they have the key, right? They have the key to the door.
Right. So that population really loves that book. Cults in Our Midst, which I did with Margaret Singer, is a really great book for survivors, but also for the general public, because it really talks all about cults and the history of the large group awareness trainings, which are very cult-like. You know, all these sort of leadership training programs now that are in all the businesses my books, I think, are good for everyone.
Right. So. Go buy them. I'll leave links down below, not to shamelessly plug products, but Jehovah's Witnesses, that's also, is that characterized as a cult or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I almost got recruited, but they've been trying a few times, and not just the standard knock on the door pamphlet techniques. I remember this was a couple of years ago. Yeah, like mid-20s. The building next to my apartment building got burned down, and a friend that I haven't talked to in a while that I knew was part of Jehovah's Witnesses, out of the blue, messages me. And I'm like, hey, what's up, man? He's like, oh, I heard there was a fire. Is everything okay? Like, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, it's the other building. I'm fine. No casualties, nothing serious. Everyone's good. I'm like, what's up with you? He's like, well, you know, he's like, I quit engineering. I'm like, okay. I'm like, so what are you doing? And he's like, I'm like washing windows for this like local church. I'm like, really? Like you quit your mechanical engineering job that you went 4 years to school for to wash windows for a church? And he's like, yeah, you know, I'm much more fulfilled now. There's, you know, more things to life than engineering. And like, I was in engineering, so I think maybe he was really trying to sell me hard on this. At the time, I couldn't think of a worse trade-off than being basically broke and washing windows to having like a decent title with a decent job. So I did not accept his lunch invitation, but yeah.
Yeah, no, the Witnesses, you know, they've been around a long time. And I think most people think they're just these nice ladies who stand on the street corners with their pamphlets or who knock on your door. But especially the sexual abuse of the children is just rampant. And finally, there's some cases that have been brought to trial. And I think there has been some exposure of what's been going on in that organization for decades, and they've kept it hidden. So I'm hoping that people will be less enticed to join the Witnesses. But it's a huge, you know, they're worldwide. It's a huge organization.
How many people? Sorry, to interrupt you. How many people do they have?
I don't know, but it's got to be thousands, if not millions. I mean, it's huge. It's huge, and the
millions, if not hundreds of millions. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm sure they'll tell you, but it's, you know, the fact that they don't let their people go to school. I mean, the kids go to regular public school, but they're completely ostracized because they can't participate in any holidays or anything, and they're not allowed to have non-Jehovah Witness friends. But they're never allowed to go to college, and so they keep the population very uneducated, and because they tell them, "Well, what's the point of going to college?" That. You know, yeah, Armageddon's going to happen tomorrow, so why go to college? And that's a really clever ploy to keep your people washing windows at churches, right?
Wow, I didn't know that. That's incredible. Yeah, that's not incredible. That's horrific, but I mean, incredible from an like interesting standpoint. But I had a friend who was actually a Jehovah's Witness. He was a good friend all the way through grade school, so up until grade 8, and then he did 1 year of high school, grade 9, and then I just didn't see him again. And he lived really close to me, and I'm like, hey man, like, are you not going to school anymore? Like, are you? He's like, no, like, I'm actually. The problem was, like, he was extremely smart because he used to love to read, so he would read on every lunch break. He was actually really smart. He would read maybe 10 books a month, like when we were kids.
Wow.
And I think they had a hard time of trying to keep him down because he was incredibly smart from all the books he's read. And I'm like, hey, are you not going to like go to, you know, high school? Are you not going to finish high school? And he said, no, I'm going to finish it at home. And then I think I'm going to become a writer. And I'm like, at the time as a kid, I mean, I guess that kind of makes, I mean, I wasn't the smartest. I wasn't like, oh, like, yeah, that doesn't make sense at all. But it made sense. You're good at, you're like reading, you want to start writing. I didn't know they actually couldn't go to higher education.
And do you know what happened to him? Are you still in touch?
I met him many years later. I didn't even realize him. I was actually playing tennis, and similar story. I asked him like, "Hey man, what's going on? What's going on in your life?" And he told me he works at Red Lobster.
Yeah, there you go. Because I mean, they keep them at that level where they can recruit, right? So they have those kinds of jobs,
right?
You know, where they have contact with the public and they can hopefully recruit. I mean, it's really, it's really debilitating for people. And so many groups do, quote, homeschooling, which is one of my pet peeves, because it's really quite unregulated. And so they do homeschooling in all of these cults, where basically all they're learning, if anything, are the words of the cult leader, right? They're not getting the actual studies having, in homeschooling. So I find that one of the really problematic issues that as a society we just don't deal with.
I mean, that's just one side of it, right? I mean, that's I would say that's even the lesser side. The worse side is social skills. You're not communicating with other kids at that age is extremely dangerous. And you know, there's people that aren't smart and they still do okay in life with social skills. I think it could be equally, if not worse, to not have social skills.
Yeah. And it, you know, it takes such a toll on a child's development, you know, because there are these developmental stages that one is supposed to go through and sort of, quote, graduate from each stage to the next stage. And that's how you build your personality and your belief system and your moral system and all of that. And the children growing up in cults don't have that, right? They're deprived of that. And of course, the human brain is not fully developed until you're 25 years old. So everything that happens to you in those early years makes a really deep impact. So
the frontal cortex, right?
Yeah.
Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm trying to think how that one friend finished engineering and had an engineering job, but I think maybe they joined later. I think they might have joined later, because that doesn't make sense at all now. But yeah, I guess it's crazy. I'm just reflecting. You've given me some epiphanies here that I didn't really expect.
Sorry.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Some thinking tonight. So what else are you currently working on? What are you most excited about? We're almost done. We're approaching an hour. I don't want to take too much of your time.
Well, I think, most exciting is the nonprofit that I'm building, the Lalich Center. And we do have a temporary website that people can sign up for our mailing list. We're running the discussion groups for survivors and some writing workshops. Right now we have a really terrific professional web development team that is building our website for free, which is wonderful. They do this only for nonprofits. So that to me is sort of the most exciting stuff that's going on right now, because I think it'll really broaden our reach. I mean, there's so much need, and already in the things we've done, I mean, we've had people from countries all over the world, from Slovenia, from Scotland, from Mexico, from Spain, from everywhere. And so there is such a huge need. And I think once we have this nonprofit set up and we have the tax deductible status, so we can take in donations, because we give a lot of scholarships to people who can't afford a lot of people coming out of cults don't have a penny to their name. And to even pay $25 for a discussion group session, they don't have that. So we love being able to give scholarships to people so they can take advantage of our services. So I that to me is the most exciting of what's going on.
There was a question I just remembered you were talking about earlier. It slipped my mind, but therapy. Are most therapists equipped to deal with someone that comes to them and says, hey, conversations? Really? No.
No. And so one thing that we have done and will continue to do is we do courses for therapists where they get CE credits to sort of educate them about what it's like to, the best things to do if you have a cult survivor or even someone who might be in a cult. We actually have a checklist. I hope it's in my book, but I hope it's on I have a website, yanyalalich.com, and I hope that checklist is there, but we do have a checklist of, what to look for in a therapist,
right?
Questions you can ask, because it's important to remember that you're hiring the therapist. They're working for you, right? So it should be what you want to do. They shouldn't be imposing, some technique or some, one of their preferred modalities on you without your agreeing to, this is what I want to do in my therapy. So having that checklist is really helpful.
Beautiful. I'll leave links to all your work, to your website. I'm sure people can browse and read your books. or they'll see you in a random cult related documentary in the next few months. Like,
I mean, I think I do 5 or 6 podcasts a week. It's just crazy.
Really? Well, thanks for your time anyways. I don't feel as special anymore, but I mean, I guess I appreciate you chatting with me, and hopefully we'll talk one day in the future.
Yeah, I'm sorry it took so long to get this scheduled, but I really enjoyed meeting you, especially because you're a fellow Serb. So, yeah, let's do this again. So
beautiful.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.